Similar to a well-tuned automobile, a guitar requires the same level of attention to perform at its very best. No matter how expensive your guitar may be, we will treat you and your instrument with the utmost respect. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson, we love guitars.
Welcome to another podcast. It's Fly's Office, brought to you by our friends at Madison Computer Works. Also, Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson. Joining us now, John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation. John, the governor signed the state budget. You say he got the best of the Republicans, but former Mayor Dave Cheslevich said he should have vetoed the whole budget and demanded redistricting reform. Thoughts?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think Cheslevich should have run for governor.
Didn't he think about it?
Probably. Everybody else did. Look, I don't fault that line. It's a fine theory. But here's the problem. You tell me. I'm gonna answer your question with a question. What did Robin Boss want most of all?
To be governor.
Yeah. Okay, you win. What did he want most of all in the budget process?
I don't know. What did he want most of all?
To embarrass and undermine, weaken in every possible way, Tony Evers.
Right.
Did that have anything to do with policy?
No.
Not at all. It's a political.
No, it's about the future. It's about him running for governor. Yeah.
If Tony Evers had vetoed the budget and demanded redistricting reform, would he have gotten it?
No.
So then we would have had no state budget. And
you're kind of using the Socratic method here.
I am a little bit.
Yeah.
What would the budget model or structure we were under be going forward?
The current.
In fact, Scott Walker budget. Right. And so Robin Boss would have had the budget he wanted.
Your dog appears to agree.
Yeah, he's cheering me on. He would have had the budget that he wanted, right? The Scott Walker budget. He wouldn't even have to do any of the sort of modestly liberal things he did to see off any problems during this fight. Remember, because, you know, Boss did bend a little bit to the politics of the moment. Then he would have had that. He would have had the Walker budget. And he would have had headlines saying, there's no budget. And who gets blamed when there's no budget?
Really? The governor.
Right. Nobody. It just doesn't happen that the legislature gets blamed. So if Evers had vetoed the budget and demanded redistricting reform, which sounds great, sounds wonderful, who would have won?
Boss.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that is why I suggest that Evers, in a kind of a three-way hit, right? Number one, launched a good budget plan, you know, put out a good vision, one that's totally, you would have loved to have seen happen, by and large. Campaigned hard for it, went out there and communicated a lot about it and built some sentiment, thus creating at least a minimal level of pressure on the legislature to adopt some of the things that were in it. Then, number two, used the veto pen effectively, right, to improve some things, you know, undercut some other things, but generally, you know, to improve the document, and then went out in a pretty honest way, I would say, and said, this isn't everything we wanted, but I was elected to be governor of the state and to make things happen, and we have, you know, that's what we're doing. I think that three-way hit, number one, given a vision, which is sort of what Cheslevich, I believe, is arguing for, right? Veto it and say, here's my vision, right? He started with a vision. Number two, knowing what he was up against, he recognized Republicans would come forward with something that was at least somewhat influenced by the vision, maybe a little better than it would have been if Evers hadn't been there. Then used the veto pen pretty aggressively, I would say, increased some education funding, addressed some health care issues, broadband issues, some criminal justice reform issues, you know, some decent stuff there. Took out some of the worst crony capitalist stuff. And then three, leveled with the people of Wisconsin. I know this is a hard concept to understand. Adult. large, I would say, when you put those pieces together, Evers comes out as the winner. Doesn't mean that it's a huge win. Doesn't mean you pop the champagne corks and shoot off the fireworks. But it does mean that the guy who beat Scott Walker came out with a better budget than Scott Walker would have done, better budget than the legislature would have done, not only because of just the pressures of the moment, but also because of the vetoes, and walks away looking to the people of Wisconsin like somebody who knows how to govern.
Well, I would say the very clever maneuver of finding a way to add the $87 million by having it start in the first year of the budget rather than the second has re-energized Democrats and how they feel about Tony Evers. I think there were a lot of people that were starting to show some concern that he didn't have the backbone, that he wasn't really taking on the Republicans as strong as he could. That single move in that budget has re-energized Democrats that I talked to.
I think you're right, and I think there's another element of it, too.
Although I think the administration's kind of playing the Republican reaction to it wrong by calling it a temper tantrum.
Yeah.
I would focus on the fact that the Republicans, once again, are trying to undermine the people of Wisconsin getting their wish, and that is fixing Wisconsin schools.
Right, and also getting an extension of Medicare.
Well, correct.
I think we can certainly argue, and I've got plenty of criticisms if you want to hear them. But if we're talking at this basic concept, right, I think you're right about that move. I think there were a couple other creative uses of the veto pen, which frankly...
By the way, the Republicans screwed up in the way that they wrote the budget. Yeah.
And you know what? That's why I use the term outwitted.
Right.
Because you outwit someone, not usually by cheating them or stealing from them. You figure out where they left you an opening, and you take it, right? And so this is the interesting thing. He did that. You are right that offset a lot of concern on the part of all sorts of folks who thought that maybe this governor just didn't have the political kind of, if it was skills or if it was backbone or whatever. The fact of the matter is, he did what he needed to do, did it, I think, pretty effectively. And here's where you get the confirmation, I think, of the points I'm making. On the day that Evers released his line, the response from the immediate response from Scott Fitzgerald, who's a much less controlled political figure than Robin Voss, was that Evers was attacking the legislative intent. He was undermining the process. There was all this sort of like pretty angry response to what Evers was doing. And then by the time that Voss and Fitzgerald had their press conference or had their response, somebody had said to him, "Oh no! You have to claim victory, right? You have to."
Yeah, let me play a little of this here. Hang on a second here. I actually have this here.
Governor Evers signed the state budget, and even though it was far less than what he asked for, he says he signed it because it invests historic amounts in education, which is something he campaigned on. He called it a down payment in progress and says he hopes to get more of his priorities funded in the next budget.
Signing a much better version of the legislature's budget with the understanding that we are nowhere near where we should be, and there's lots more work that we need to do.
In total, schools will get $570 million. Evers used his line item veto to increase public school funding by $100 million. This is the largest increase for public schools in Wisconsin's history. The state allocated $465 million for road and highway projects. Plus, middle-income earners will see a 10% tax cut. Evers partially vetoed 78 provisions in the budget, including a $2.5 million transportation study, building a new prison in Green Bay, and removing requirements for those who receive food stamps. He also eliminated a provision to allow Tesla to sell its vehicles directly to customers. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said in a statement, "This conservative budget crafted by the Republican legislature deserved to be signed into law, but without the political partial vetoes. The final budget is no longer a liberal wish list. It's more fiscally responsible." Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald echoed the same tone.
I mean, my point is, Ben, he basically signed the Republican version of the budget today. So there's a list of items, but none of them jump out at me so significant that I think you can make the case that he really changed the document that we passed on the floor of the Senate last week.
Didn't say that with a lot of heart.
No, of course. I mean, these were typed up, you know, this is what you have to say. And you know why they had to say that? Do you notice how they both emphasized, you know, that it's a conservative document, because one of the, if we had the level of state house coverage that we once had in Wisconsin, everybody would be aware that there was a conservative revolt against the Republican budget.
Right.
And that very conservative members of the state Senate, especially in Fitzgerald's chamber, but also in the assembly as well, suggested that they might vote against the document because it was too liberal, right? And the bottom line is that because Voss really would like to be governor, and because the Republicans also know that in relatively short order, some of them might actually face the voters in competitive elections after a redistricting, they did include some more liberal elements. They moved beyond the sort of rigid conservative approach to a number of issues in crafting the budget. And what Evers, so that in itself is a measure of victory by the fact, for Evers, in the fact he got elected, so the legislature wasn't dealing with Scott Walker, they're now dealing with somebody who's pulling in a certain direction. And they made some compromises into that zone. That offended their most conservative members.
Senator Craig.
But several of them, yeah.
Yeah.
And some of them were public and maybe even sincere conservatives. Other ones were like, gripe. They say, oh, wow, you mean if I gripe about not backing this thing, maybe I can get some scam thing, you know, some crony capitalist thing for some buddy of mine? But at the end of the day, Fitzgerald especially, but Voss as well, were bargaining with their own members, struggling to get the votes that they needed to get the thing passed. They got it passed. They could not then go up and say, yeah, we made you guys vote for a budget that you didn't think was conservative enough. Now Evers has altered it in all sorts of ways that you would describe as liberal,
which
he won.
Which tells me the groundwork that Governor Evers and Lieutenant Governor Barnes did leading up to this fight and the traveling around the state had an impact.
I think so. In fact, I think it not only had an impact, but to my view, it. I think that they shifted the debate, and where they shifted the debate was especially on the education issues, and especially, frankly, on rural education issues. My sense is that Voss and Fitzgerald had to begin from a more moderate place, simply because of the reality of the 2018 election and the popular sentiment on behalf of doing something about the schools in general, but especially for rural schools. So bottom line was the budget that came to pass was a better budget. Not a great budget, not one. I'm not going to, you know, go, oh, wow, you know, Evers really so outwitted him that he got them to pass a great budget. No, that's not the case. That's not what happened. What happened is that Evers got them to move a little bit to reflect the moment that everybody was in, the stuff that was going on. And then at that point, once the budget, this little bit move budget, came across the line, he then showed skills that, frankly, I have to admit I wasn't sure that he had. It's not a criticism of the guy. New governors, you know, kind of evolve into this position, especially those who haven't been in the legislature. But he showed more skill than I expected with the vetoes. And that was a really interesting thing. It isn't just with the budgeting moves as regards education funding. If you look at just little things like an effort by the Republicans to move money to county jails, right, which was very popular with a lot of rural counties, and in fact had some component of this overall effort to deal with, you know, frankly, our need for criminal justice reform. He altered things there that will affect the long-term debate on how we do criminal justice reform, and I think ultimately undermine some privatization schemes and all sorts of other sort of gimmickry as regards doing criminal justice reform. So it's good stuff. You know what I mean? It's just, if you look at the overall package, I think the governor took a slightly improved budget as a result of the groundwork he laid, things that you talk about, and then overlaid that with a series of vetoes that made it.
You haven't shown any remorse or regret and sympathy for Senator Chris Kapinka of Delafield for his fine efforts to help Tesla.
Yeah, you know, I really respect you know, I respect what he did. And you're like, yeah, because what puts you more in tune with the working guy, right? Now, I know that Tesla, if I'm not mistaken.
Isn't it mostly rich liberals who drive Teslas?
Yeah, I think there's several on my street. But help me with this. I think it's mostly rich European liberals. Help me out with this one, Sly, if you will, right? If you want to really say, you know, yeah, we're on behalf of the working men and women of Wisconsin and stuff like that, and they are really upset about, you know, not having easy enough access to Teslas. You know, I got to tell you, I'm out there a little bit in rural Wisconsin talking to farmers.
His performance at his press conference with the crying and everything, I have to tell you, that was and by the way, nobody likes the guy. He's just a horrible person.
Yeah, well, it's just like, also, what is he objecting to? He says, well, you know, I tried to corrupt the process as best I could, but I couldn't pull it off. And
all right, let's take a break. John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation at SlysOffice.com.
When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
I want to thank all the labor unions here in Dane County that help keep SlysOffice.com up and going so you keep up to date. Whether it be the Madison Firefighters, Local 311, or the Madison Teamsters, Local 695, or our friends at Madison Teachers Incorporated. These are some of the most active local unions who organize, and constantly stand up for workers. Thank you from SlysOffice.com. Welcome back to SlysOffice.com, brought to you by our friends at Madison Teachers Incorporated, Madison Firefighters, Local 311, and, of course, Madison Teamsters, Local 695. Joining us again, John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation. The presidential race. NBC came out with a poll yesterday that showed Joe Biden kind of bouncing back, being at 26%, Elizabeth Warren at 19%, and then Kamala Harris and Bernie Sanders at 12%. Tell me your thoughts of this race right now.
Yeah, there's a lot of polls coming out, right?
How do you think the Michael Bennett juggernaut is going?
It's him or Hickenlooper. I don't know which Coloradan's going over the top, but you know, I mean,
actually, here Hickenlooper's about to drop out. So.
Yeah, 'cause he literally let go of his. He's letting go of his staff, and it's one of the more hilarious, this is just a brief intermission here, one of the more hilarious things is the poor, actually very capable press secretary for the Hickenlooper campaign had to describe all these staff changes and put them in a positive light. Yeah, he's bringing in new people and stuff like that. And then they asked about her continuing role, and she said, well, I'm leaving too. You're sort of like, oh my gosh. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that his press secretary, who may be in the process of departing, I won't speak for other people, is Randy Bryce's former campaign.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Huh. Which is fine. She was really good. And, in fact, Hickenlooper, when he came into the race, hired some very capable people. And as we're noting, it's similar to the Beto O'Rourke situation. The potential candidate got out there in the game, a lot of these capable people realize there might be better ways for them to spend 2020. And so where the race is right now is a fascinating thing. I'll tell you two things that I think are important to understand. First tier, kind of vital understanding. There is a bunching that is starting to take place in this campaign, and it involves four candidates. With a fifth one trying to get that four. The four candidates who are bunching are Biden, Warren, Sanders-Harris. If you look at most of the recent polls that have come out, those four are somewhere in a line. Biden always at the top. Some polls will have Sanders in second. Some will have Warren in second. There was even one, I think, that had Harris moving, you know, into that highest tier area. But this is the four, if you will. That's important to understand, because if you know about, you know, margins of error going up or down, when you look at that, where Warren, Sanders, and Harris are in that NBC poll, you know, you add your 3 points one way or the other on those, it's not clear that somebody's really established, you know, a solid you're the rival to Biden situation. So understand that. And then you have fifth candidate, Buttigieg, who potentially could still move into there, especially if he had a good debate performance coming up, something like that.
And he's raised a lot of money.
Tons of money, and will probably raise more. And it certainly has with Buttigieg, what I found is I was just traveling a lot around the country. I was struck by how many people are interested in him but not necessarily backing him. And so he's got some potential there. That's real. Here's what I think is important. Beyond those five, four definitely in what I would call the upper tier, and then a fifth one maybe moving in, nobody else is above 2% in that NBC poll. That's including, you know that in number six position, you know who it is in that poll?
Who's that?
Andrew Yang.
Oh, yeah.
And and then he's essentially tied with Beto O'Rourke. And then suddenly below those two at the 2% level, roughly, you end up with this massive number at 1% or zero, and that's including, you know, pretty significant figures like Cory Booker, Gillibrand, you know, all sorts of other folks. I think we are, what I'm taking away from the polls is this. I don't think Biden is in fantastic shape, but I don't think he's in horrible shape. I mean, he's survived a hard hit. He's going to have to do really well going forward, because the vulnerability is there.
Yeah, but you know, for that moment, stylistically, there's no doubt that Harris scored some points. Biden has shown some contrition in the way that he brought up the segregationists. But on the issue of busing, then Harris did a flip-flop and went back to Biden's position about, well, you know, maybe voluntary, maybe, you know, it's one tool. It's she kind of retrenched on that issue. And I think that damaged her.
It may have to some extent, and I will see.
I think it's forward. A terrible issue for Democrats anyway. But
you're litigating an issue that was complicated at the time, and
nobody wants to revisit.
Well, nobody wants to revisit it, but also nobody seems to be willing to go through all the gradations of it, right? And so if you do, you end up in this situation where. You start a logical argument. You're going to say, yeah, I favor this because I really favor integration. It's vital. At the same time, you don't want African-American kids to be bearing the brunt of this, right? And, you know, so there's all these factors that I think Harris, to her credit, as she reflected on it, offered a good response. It's just that it was different than what you saw in the debate. And I do think that potentially put a little burden on her. By the same token, in just a purely political sense, Harris got what she needed out of that debate, and that was to be seen as someone who is capable of prosecuting the front runner, you know, standing on stage in a debate and really taking the front runner down effectively. And for her, that was very, very important. She's moved up in the polls. If we're going to take a look at the first two debates and whatever played out of that, that is the only headline that comes out of it.
So as we play this out, you know, I've talked to people in the Sanders campaign, I'm not sure they view Elizabeth Warren as their main rival, even though they're on the same ideological spectrum. I think they're fighting for voters that are looking at Biden.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, the polling suggests that's why.
So Bernie has had a tough time attracting older voters. Why is that?
I think there's a couple factors in it. Number one, he is running a campaign that in many ways addresses issues from the perspective of now. You know, and there's, I'll hear people say that this guy we mentioned a moment ago, Andrew Yang, who's talking about a universal basic income and a host of other technology-related reforms, is the, you know, the real 21st century candidate. Well, to some extent, yeah, just on the bells and whistles, I'll give you that. But the reality is that Sanders is the one who is looking at kind of the evolving economy, where it stands today, where it is heading, and what you have to do within it. And that is that you're going to have to develop a national health care plan because people aren't going to get their benefits from traditional union contracts, at least in the short term.
Yes, but you know what? I think he's done a terrible job of explaining that.
I agree.
Seriously, but, you know, the component that you just brought up about looking towards the future, you know, you have all the talking heads like, oh, don't bring up Medicare for all. That's just terrible, blah, blah, blah. It's a killer, blah, blah, blah. Well, first of all, I don't think that that's really the way the American public feels. But second, I'd like to hear their answer, knowing the changes in our gig economy and what their answer is about employers. The other thing I have never quite understood in this country is, why aren't employers the one pushing for Medicare for all?
Well, they are.
Think about the burden that would be off their backs.
Yeah, and in fact, you realize that a number have. You know, when they had, you know, even going back to the Clinton reforms, you had a surprising number of CEOs step up and say, "We could live with that." Right? Maybe they didn't like some elements of it, but let me finish this core concept because you're right in what you're saying there. Sanders is scoping stuff out when he's talking about Medicare for all, education, a host of these other issues, universal plans that make guarantees. For young voters, that makes total sense. And Sanders doesn't have to explain a lot of it because they're actually looking at their reality. And so as a result, he continues to poll extremely well among younger voters. It's like he's a very logical candidate for the moment. For older voters who have literally, you know, kind of been, you know, generationally run through the fantasy of, you know, neoliberal economics, austerity, all these other things, these proposals seem pretty radical, right? And you hit on it when you responded when I was talking about Medicare for All. Sanders really still needs to develop a better speech, and the speech ought to be, you know, it's something I've said to you 20 times. We're 30 years into globalization, 20 years into digital revolution, 10 years into an automation revolution. These are changing everything about how we live. If you want to get ready for the future, and if you want to beat Donald Trump, who only talks about the past, you've got to start to think in a different and frankly, more optimistic way about the future.
But as far as the older voters go,
yeah,
we start talking about Social Security. If I were Bernie Sanders and I were to take on Joe Biden in a debate, first of all, I think you need to effectively prosecute the fact that, and maybe put it in more human terms. Bernie rattles off NAFTA, GATT.
He
needs to put it in more human terms, the costs of free trade. But also, the Obama administration's tinkering with the notion of going after Social Security.
Yeah, chain CPI.
Yeah, like chain CPI, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Draw some differentiation there. And I tell you what, I think he could draw some blood.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I lost you for a second.
I think he could draw some blood.
I think you're right about that. And I also think that, and people say this a lot as regards Sanders, who, by the way, I don't think is in as much trouble as some people say.
I'm worried.
Well, I understand that, and I respect that. He continues to hold a solid base. And if you look at polling out of early primary and caucus states, he continues to look very solid in those places. And remember, the national polls are one part of this. They suggest where some sentiments are heading. But the state-by-state ones matter as well. And Sanders, I think, continues to have a lot of traction. He's also poured a lot of money into those early places. So we'll see where it all plays out. But what I would say is it's clear to me that Sanders has a challenge in one key area, and that is to be a politician in the classic sense. And he resists that. He doesn't like it because it wouldn't play well in Vermont where he came up, and also because it just hasn't been his style. But he's got to get better, in my opinion, at saying, who do you think is really going to defend Social Security? And do that and say, because that's going to be a fight we're going to have with Donald Trump. Donald Trump is already bankrupting the country with tax breaks for the wealthy. They're going to come at us with this austerity argument, and the compromise is going to be undercutting Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, all these other programs. We know that's what they're going to do, and how have people responded to that in the past? Let's talk about some of the people
right
on stage.
That's right.
That's how you frame it. You
right
don't just go after Biden. But
right.
You.
One final thing, just a short response on this. The launch of Amy McCrath's campaign in Kentucky against Mitch McConnell. What did you think of her launch ad?
Launch ad was great. The letters?
Yeah.
The letters to McConnell.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was quite good. Really very, very strong. But then some stumbling along as regards what she would have done with the Kavanaugh nomination.
Right, right.
And so, a well-packaged opening and then a policy stumble on an issue that, you know, there's not a middle ground on that one, right? If you're running against McConnell, it's clear where you need to be. And also, I think it's credible where you need to be. And so she stumbled there. And you do get one stumble out of the gate, you know, but you can't have any more. You can't get that reputation as a campaign that's not quite ready for what it's doing. So I would say right now she had a great, you know, first number of hours, a tough...
Well, because she's running against a national figure, there's
yeah
money coming in nationally, right? It's coming
she'll
in.
She'll have money.
Right, she'll
yeah
have money.
Yeah.
But the one thing I'd hate to see is especially some of the lefty groups that are pouring money in there, they need her to have some distance from the national party.
Well, they need her.
She needs to be Amy McGrath. She's not a lefty.
Right. Well,
and you know what? I don't think it's contrived. I think she's actually a pretty moderate person.
Yeah, which is, you know, I mean, in many
it's
ways.
It's Kentucky.
Where you talk about. But, you know, this is where the quick problem, I'll say, with the left-right calculus is that left-right in this country, the way that it's discussed in media, tends to be a rubric of social issues and a little bit of economics. I think that in Kentucky there are ways to be very progressive on economics.
Well, you know where I'm coming from on this.
Yeah,
I'm not
right
talking
right
about that. I am talking about her getting trapped into social, into the divide on social issues,
so
the culture war.
Here's what you do. You turn the volume up on the economics, right? And you can be as progressive as you want, because you know that McConnell's going to attack you no matter what. Whatever stand you take, no matter how moderate you are, McConnell's going to paint you as, you know, every negative he can or every image that he wants to throw on that. That's going to be there. So you can be as progressive as you want on the social issues, but what you have to do is make a deep connection with people on the economics, the Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and a host of other economic issues. It's doable. And the fact of the matter is, I think we may see this fall in Kentucky election results that tell you how doable that is.
It will be an indicator, although there is some difference between, and you know this, a statewide race having to do with the governing of Kentucky versus national politics and a seat held in Washington, D.C.
100%, and in a presidential
right
year.
Right. But if she's gonna win, she's got to win back far eastern Kentucky and southeastern Kentucky,
yep,
along the Virginia and North Carolina and the border over there with West Virginia, and then she's got to win far western Kentucky, over there by Missouri. Those are the two spots, in addition obviously to winning Lexington and Louisville, that you've got to win if you're a Democrat in Kentucky. I can tell you that map verbatim.
Yeah, I know you know the map, and frankly, there are maps like that from states across this country.
Right.
And, you know, look, I'll tell you the final thing on McGrath stepping up. She's a pretty good candidate, I think. She did very well in her congressional race, didn't pull it off, and you can use that for what it's worth. But she's a credible catch as a contender. And one of the things I really want to emphasize is that, you know, we talked earlier about the presidential race and the number of candidates who, you know, frankly, just aren't getting their numbers. And the prospect that we may really finally see another people drop out of the presidential. There is a profound need to refocus on the Senate races because, you know, I'll leave you and the audience with this question. If you had to choose between having the presidency and having control of the Senate, potentially in combination with the House, I'm not going to play some casual game and say, oh, yeah, of course you'd take the Congress. But I would suggest after the last, you know, 15 years, we have a lot of evidence that, you know, controlling the Congress is a parallel power to that of the presidency. And yet I think Democrats are not, they're not as excited about the Senate as they should be.
Well, just remember, it was Roger Ailes who did the famous ads for Mitch McConnell in 1984. Mitch McConnell was a long shot against incumbent Walter D. Huddleston.
Yep.
Won by 5,000 votes.
And, if I might add, ran at that in that time not as some big right-winger, but ran as a guy who had been a pretty prominent local government official and actually occasionally even run with union support.
In the state's most liberal county.
That's right. So when we begin to understand that Mitch McConnell will be anything he needs to be to win an election, the challenge really is to make sure that his opponent is something strong and clear.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation. Thanks for coming to SliceOffice.com.
SliceOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.